This is Empower the Spirit with Dr. Douglas Kelly.
And good morning for Sunday, May 22nd, 2011. My name is Doug Kelly. It's so good to have you joining us on this live program or on the archive. It's a great day today, and we're going to be talking about a couple of different topics. The first topic up on the agenda is Mind, Where is Your Mind? Evidence for Non-Locality. And we also have Reverend Vicki Hunter joining us again today. She's going to talk about how to live your truth and walk your own path. Empower the Spirit is a weekly broadcast of the Metaphysical Church of Humanistic Science as a part of our regular church services. Our mission is to explore and empower the human spirit, and this program addresses metaphysical topics with a focus on a variety of practical life skills that you can use in your own day-to-day life. It's a program about enhancing the human condition and empowering the human spirit. Now today, for those of you joining us live on this broadcast in the chat room, if you have any questions, feel free to post them in there. I will try to address those as we can throughout the program. On today's topic, my topic, Where is Your Mind? Evidence for Non-Locality. This really covers our MCHS principle of belief number 6, and I'll read that principle of belief. We believe the nature of a human being encompasses both a physical and spiritual aspect, and therefore maintain an open but grounded mind to potential realities as yet undescribed by science. I wanted to kind of give you some foundation for this whole issue of non-locality. And the foundation that I want to talk about is some differences in philosophies. One of the philosophies that I want to explain is that called materialism. Now, materialism is not what you might think, you know, having a materialistic attitude. I just want things. It's not what I'm talking about. Materialism is basically a philosophy that states that everything can be explained through physical matter. And more accurately, or more specifically, I should say, for our conversation this morning, the mind and consciousness can be explained by chemical processes in the brain. In other words, the mind consciousness is a product of the physical brain. That is a materialistic philosophy. Much of mainstream science adheres to this kind of a philosophy, that everything in the universe can be explained with physical matter. The opposite of materialism is called idealism. That philosophy says that nothing essentially is real. Everything is created by consciousness. All physical matter is a product of conscious creation. So they're two monistic theories, kind of opposite. There's yet a third one. Of course, there's a zillion of them, but the third one we'll talk about is that called dualism. Now, dualism combines essentially both materialism and idealism. It basically says that we have both a physical and a spiritual aspect or nature to us as human beings. The mind consciousness is that spiritual aspect. It cannot be explained by chemical processes in the brain. And we'll talk more about how to look at this as we go. Now, MCHS Church has a dualistic belief system. We believe in both the physical and spiritual aspects of human nature. In fact, it could be probably summed up pretty well with a very familiar quote. I'm sure you've probably heard it. This was actually originally quoted by 20th century French philosopher, paleontologist, and Jesuit priest, and I'm not sure I'll pronounce his name correctly, but I'll try, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. And he said or wrote, "We are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience." So you've probably heard that quote. It's fairly common, but it's a good one. We are essentially spiritual creatures having a physical experience. The reason for this dualistic belief, that is, we have physical and spiritual nature, is that there are things that we just can't explain by chemical processes in the brain. For example, psychic ability can't be readily explained by chemical processes in the brain. Another one is psychokinesis, where things are seemingly affected by one's consciousness, one's psyche. I mean, there are instances that are pretty well documented. I've seen it. I've experienced it in my research. And it's pretty fascinating. It's pretty spectacular. But these are processes of the human mind, and they can't be explained by chemical processes. Some other things that can't be explained by chemical processes are the connection that we have to each other, specifically and kind of powerfully, for example, between a mother and her children. Often a mother will know when her children or child is in danger or something's happened. And there's also the documented connection between twins, some kind of a psychic connection. So the question follows, where does this connection come from? How is it that we're connected? Because we are connected. Well, there's a couple of principles that I want to, again, give you some foundation on that will help you to understand this whole concept of non-locality of consciousness. The first principle is called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Back in 1927, German physicist Werner Heisenberg, he was a pioneer in quantum theory, published what he called the uncertainty principle, and it states, the more precisely the position of a particle is determined, the less precisely the momentum is known in this instant, and vice versa. Now, let me simplify this. It simply means that the act of observing an experiment can change the outcome. And this has also been called the observer effect. Some people differentiate between the uncertainty principle and the observer effect, but by and large, for our purposes, they're the same thing. When you observe something, you have an impact on it. And there's more to this. I'm really trying to simplify this whole discussion. It can get pretty deep. So the uncertainty principle simply means the act of observing can affect the outcome. Now, the other principle that is huge in non-locality is called quantum entanglement. You may have heard of that before. It sounds kind of, I don't know, it sounds deep. It sounds very scientific, but it's really a very simple concept. Quantum entanglement was described by Erwin Schrödinger, one of the fathers of quantum theory, as the characteristic trait of quantum mechanics. Now, entanglement simply means connected. If you think about two things which are entangled with each other, they're connected, they're intertwined. Now, this word entanglement was coined by Erwin Schrödinger, and it's a theory that says when two particles are entangled, connected that is, they remain connected regardless of how far apart they become, and that can even be across the universe. So, let me just sum up. Uncertainty principle, the act of observing can affect the outcome. Quantum entanglement simply means being connected, and it means that when one thing changes, the other thing changes as well. In fact, a little bit more on that. When an action is performed on one particle through quantum entanglement, the other particle responds instantly, not at the speed of light. That's not instant. It might seem instant, but it's not. But the other particle responds instantly, just as if it was the same particle as the other one. And the interesting and fascinating thing about it, there is no known means of communication between the two. There's no radio link. There's no psychic link that we know of. And this obviously violates Einstein's special theory of relativity. Remember, E equals mc squared, which sets the speed limit on how fast things can go in the universe. And that speed limit, of course, is the speed of light. And so this whole quantum entanglement thing is absolutely fascinating because when two particles are entangled or connected, when one changes, the other changes instantly. Instantly, with no known means of communication. They are connected. They are entangled. And, of course, this is faster than the speed of light. And this is one of the reasons why Einstein never really endorsed quantum mechanics. Entanglement and the uncertainty principle go hand in hand. So we have the uncertainty principle, which means the act of observing can affect the outcome, and entanglement, where simply things are connected. They're really not difficult concepts to understand in our context here. One interpretation of the entanglement concept is known as the Copenhagen interpretation, and it says that the act of measurement causes the calculated set of probabilities to collapse to a value defined by the measurement. Now, let me simplify that. What it says essentially is this: reality does not become real until it is observed. I'll repeat it. Reality does not become real or coherent until it is observed. Fascinating concepts. So let's bring this all together and kind of connect it to non-locality and consciousness. In physics, the principle of locality states that any object can only be influenced by its immediate surroundings. In other words, the sun is not influenced by the gravitational pull of Alpha Centauri because they're 4 light-years apart. You know what? You won't get rained on if it's not raining here, but raining, 2 miles down the road. You know, your immediate surroundings affect you. I can't push you physically unless you're within arm's reach. So that's the principle of locality in physics, that something can only be influenced by its immediate surroundings. However, experiments in quantum mechanics, which is on a very, very, very small level, have proven that the principle of locality is untrue, at least on the quantum level. Now remember, in quantum entanglement, two particles are connected so that when one is affected, the other one also responds instantly with no known means of communication and regardless of distance. This means that particles can be light years apart, that is non-local, and still be connected. That is quantum entanglement, and that is non-locality by definition. Quantum entanglement is non-locality by definition. So what does this non-locality mean, especially with regard to the mind and consciousness? It simply means that the mind, your consciousness, is not contained within the brain. Now, there's some fascinating evidence for this, which I'm getting to, and I talked about this last week in our program. I was going to reveal some of this evidence last week, and it just didn't work out in that program, so I'm revealing it today. So let's give you an example of what non-locality means to a human being, and let's use an analogy of a computer. If you consider that a computer possesses a central processing unit known as a CPU, that's your chip. It also has what is called a graphical user interface, or a GUI. The graphical user interface is simply Windows. For example, if you have a Windows-based machine or a Mac, you have this software that basically allows you to connect with your computer. There's also the hardware, such as the screen, the keyboard, the mouse, and there's also, of course, memory. Now, in this analogy, the CPU, the graphical user interface, that is the software, and the memory would represent the brain. The keyboard and screen would represent the senses in a human being. And you, the user, would represent the non-local mind or consciousness, since you are not part of that computer. You're outside of it. You're non-local to the computer. Now, computers cannot do anything without programming. And that is somebody telling them what to do. Therefore, a computer is only meaningful if a non-local force, that is you, acts on it. The brain without consciousness is kind of like a computer with no user, pointless, meaningless. So that's an example of what non-locality means. It simply means that your mind is not contained within the brain. The brain acts like a graphical user interface, if you will. Even memories are fascinating. There's evidence to suggest that even our memories are non-local to the brain. We often think about memory being made up of all these synaptic connections, zillions of them, giving our brain an infinite storage capacity. But different experiments have shown that memory is not lost, even when the brain is sliced in different directions. And this defies the assumption that storage is actually in the brain. They can actually take pieces of the brain out, and it does not result in a loss of memory. You would think that if you cut your computer memory in half somehow, you'd think you'd lose, you know, all your files, or more accurately, your hard drive. If you cut your hard drive in half, you lose half the information you have. Well, that's not the way it is with the brain, or excuse me, with the mind. You can slice the brain a little bit, but you still have all these memories. And so, therefore, it's non-local. It's kind of like a hologram. You know, you may or may not know this, but when you take a hologram, you know, when you can see this image that kind of looks 3D as you change your perspective to it, you can cut that in half, and you'll still have the complete image of that hologram. It's the way it works. And so this has given rise to theories such as the holographic theory of the mind or the holographic theory of the universe. The point here being is that non-locality is the nature of consciousness. The mind, consciousness, it's outside of space-time. No scientist can prove where the mind is. We don't know where the mind is. It can't prove it's in the brain. It seems to be outside. It seems to be non-local. Well, this obviously has a lot of implications to us as human beings, to our nature as human beings. And that's consequently why our belief system includes a spiritual, that is, mind, consciousness, aspect, as well as a physical aspect. Here's some experiments showing or verifying or supporting the concept of non-locality of the mind and consciousness. Back in 1993, there was a experiment called the Paired Students Experiment. Back in 1993, University of Mexico neurophysiologist, and I'll try to pronounce his name as well, Jacobo Grinberg Zilberbaum, conducted experiments involving the brain activity of paired students. Now, this experiment's been repeated too, but it's fascinating. Here's how it worked. They would get two students to meditate together. These two students didn't know each other. They would put these two students together to meditate with the intention of direct yet non-vocal communication. After about 20 minutes, they separated these two students. These two students can still continue their unifying intention of connecting with one another mentally. They placed each one of these students apart in different rooms, and in some cases, different parts of the campus. And they were in these rooms, which included a Faraday cage. You may or may not be familiar with that. A Faraday cage is simply an electromagnetically shielded cage so that other radio signals and stuff cannot enter into this Faraday cage. So these two students were each in their own Faraday cage in different rooms apart. They were both connected to an electroencephalogram, which is an EEG machine. It measures brain activity. One of the subjects was shown a series of light flashes, which were designed to induce brain activity, and it would show up on this EEG machine. It would be recorded on it. And the fascinating thing about it is that when the primary subject, when they did these flashes of light or showed them images or something, the brain reacted. It was measured on the EEG. But the other student, who was also connected to the EEG, also had similar brain activity at the same instant. How is this possible if they are not connected? Well, we can explain it through quantum entanglement. Those two students spent time connecting with the deliberate intent of connecting. And it showed up when one student had the flashes of light, visible flashes of light, registered on that student's EEG machine. The other student's EEG also responded with the same readings, even though that student could see no visible flashes of light. Fascinating. It also goes to show how deliberate intent is powerful. Talk a little bit more about that in a moment. This whole thing about quantum entanglement, being connected with somebody. Take yourself, for example. Do you have experiences like this where you're really connected to somebody? My wife Tracy and I constantly have these instances of having the same idea or thought, almost to the point of saying it at the same time. In fact, we do that on occasion. I've often said about her and me that we're not on the same page. We're more like on the same paragraph and often on the same word. It's kind of spooky. We are entangled. In fact, this entanglement is known as action at a distance. And it can be spooky, and that's why Einstein called it spooky action at a distance. Here's another piece of evidence that I absolutely find amazing. Back on February 2nd, 1966, polygraph expert Cleve Baxter, and his last name is spelled B-A-C-K-S-T-E-R, if you want to look him up, there's some fascinating videos on YouTube. But this polygraph expert, Cleve Baxter, stumbled on a monumental discovery with far-reaching implications regarding consciousness. In 1966, he attached a plant to a polygraph. He got thinking, you know, I wonder if a plant would respond to any kind of this stuff. And so he connected this plant to a polygraph machine. And the interesting thing about this is that, of course, he's a scientist. He's thinking, you know, about research and about testing. And so he connects it, and he then thinks, you know, what would happen? Would it generate a reading if I burned a leaf? As soon as he thought that, with the intent of going into the next room and getting some matches to do it, the polygraph machine reacted. In other words, the plant reacted. Think about that. The instant he thought about burning the plant, he didn't even burn it, but he thought about it, the plant reacted. Of course, that blew him away, and it's amazing. How could it know? How could it know? He then did subsequent experiments, quite a few of them. Many of them are again, available if you look up Cleve, C-L-E-V-E, Baxter, on YouTube. You can see some of the videos. They did experiments. One in particular is that they had a plant there connected to a polygraph, and they had boiling water with some brine shrimp, you know, positioned above it. And they had it connected to a timer and a motor, and Cleve himself would take off, and it would all be automated and had video cameras on it. And at a certain time, the timer would kick in, and those brine shrimp would be poured into the boiling water. When they did this, the plant reacted. Even though it was not connected, it reacted. Again, how do you explain this? Well, there must be something beyond isolated units. We're apparently not isolated units. We are connected. That quantum entanglement. We are connected. Back in 2003, Cleve published a book, Primary Perception, Biocommunication with Plants, Living Foods, and Human Cells. I mean, they did experiments on this with a lot of different things. Absolutely amazing. They even did some experiments with the space station with these types of things, red blood cells white blood cells and different things like that. You know, this evidence is nothing short of amazing, absolutely amazing. It seems to prove that we are connected, even on a cellular level, with other living things, even plants. Who would have thunk? We're connected by quantum entanglement. And even more far-reaching, it underscores the power of deliberate intent. Because remember, in the first paired students experiment, those two students had the intent of connecting. When Cleve Baxter was thought about burning the plant, it reacted. It was an intent. That's powerful. And it's a powerful quality that we all have. That power of intent can actually make a difference in our lives. If a lowly plant can pick up on the intentions of a human being, what does this indicate about our thoughts and intentions regarding others, or the planet, or the universe? If plants and cells can pick up on our intent, what about the universal consciousness? So let's sum up what we talked about here. The evidence for the mind or consciousness being outside the brain or being non-local is compelling. It's overwhelming. And this fact underscores the dual nature of human beings. That is, we have both a physical and spiritual nature. Our spiritual nature manifests in a variety of ways, including psychic abilities. Furthermore, everything is connected to everything else by this universal consciousness, this quantum entanglement, even low forms of life like plant life. And another thing we discovered here is that deliberate intent is a powerful force that we use even without thinking about it. How much better it is when we deliberately use our power of deliberate intent to the benefit of others. In fact, here's a quick good exercise. Right now, think of somebody that you know of that's having a hard time. Probably not going to be too difficult. Think of somebody, a friend, an acquaintance, somebody that you care about. They're having a hard time. Take a few seconds, just a couple of moments right now. Close your eyes. Deliberately form an intent to send them some positive energy. Think of the person. Make a deliberate choice to send them positive energy. And now do it. Visualize that energy being released from you and going out to that person. Instantly, it helps, and it does good for us to do that as well. Now, let me check the chat room for questions before I shift gears. One question is, if reality cannot exist without observation, how does quantum entanglement happen without observation? Is it not the observing that creates the entanglement? And the answer, my answer, I don't know. They are interconnected. They work together. There's also other parts of it. There's a superposition, they call it, which I didn't get into because I was trying to keep things more on the simple side of things. So I'm gonna have to think about the question and perhaps give you an answer later, Kathy. I wish I could answer it, but I don't know the answer to it. I don't know how they're all connected. I don't know if anybody knows, but give that some thought. Thanks for your question, though. Now let's shift gears for just a moment. If you've been listening to this live broadcast this morning, or even the archive later, you probably missed it. You missed the rapture that was supposed to happen today, yesterday, May 21st, 2011. You most likely heard about the predictions made by Harold Camping of Family Radio. He predicted that approximately 200 million people would be raptured by 6 p.m. on Saturday, May 21st, 2011, that earthquakes would occur around the planet at that time as well. Whatever your time zone was, it didn't matter. 6 p.m., you'd have earthquakes. There would be the rapture. Of course, nothing happened yesterday, last night. Well, they're the typical earthquakes that occur on the planet, but nothing like he predicted. Now, I'm not bringing this up in an effort to make fun of them. I won't do that because I was once one of them, not his particular group, but part of a doomsday religion. Interesting thing about, though, this current situation, this May 21st doomsday prophecy, is that there were a lot of people who bought into it. Of course, most people didn't, but there were a lot of people who did. One man by the name of Robert Fitzpatrick in New York City was reported as spending his life savings of over $140,000 on subway signs and billboards. He spent yesterday, Saturday, handing out pamphlets and was quoted as saying how he couldn't understand why nothing happened at 6 p.m. I can just feel it. You know, he believed in it. He gave up everything he had for it. Many people did. And nothing happened, and they couldn't wrap their brain around it. You know, it's not so much comical as it is sad. A lot of people want hope. One of the traits of human nature is the need for hope. And a lot of people don't have hope. And so they look to things outside themselves. They look to these other people who come up with these crazy dates. They've been doing this for thousands of years. You know, these dates, predicting the end of the world. I mean, look back over the last 150 years. Back in the 1840s, the Millerites predicted, I think it was 1942, forget the exact date, in the fall, September something, September 2nd maybe. They predicted that the world would end there, or that, you know, Jesus would come back and grab everybody who was faithful. Of course, that never happened. That led to some divisions in the Millerites, and out of those divisions came several other religions. One of them is Jehovah's Witnesses, another one was the Second-Day Adventists, and another one was the Seventh-Day Adventists. They've all been spawned by the Millerites back in the 1840s, and they've all had their failed predictions of the end of the world, all of these and many others. But it's not, these predictions of the end of the world are not so much limited to religion either. I mean, some scientists have predicted the end of the world as well, whether it's Yellowstone blowing up, whether it's a magnetic polar shift, a meteorite, or meteor rather, hitting the Earth, global warming, or some other natural disaster. It's just, people always seem, are always trying to predict the end of the world. I don't know why they all want the world to end. And I think it goes back to that hope. They want something better. And so if this world ends, that can only be better, right? Well, a lot of them teach that. But folks, it is what it is. Life is what it is. The world is not going to end. And if I'm wrong, and if it does, what are we going to do about it? The point here being is, number one, don't waste any energy on that kind of a thing. It's pointless. The world is not going to end. The Earth is resilient. You know, it goes back to the myth of global warming and all this other crap that we're handed in an effort to control us through fear. You can't be controlled through fear. The world will not end. And investing energy is a negative pursuit. Another problem with these predictions is, and also with religions such as Christianity and others, is that they teach you to look outside of yourself for answers. Look at all these people. People spent their lives, quit their jobs, spent their money, and this is nothing new with this recent occurrence. This has happened every time. People give it all away in an effort to push this belief. The world's going to end. We got to do what we can do to be considered faithful by God so that he might just probably, you know, save us in the end. Well, you know what? They're looking outside of themselves for something. And that is the problem, because the answers do not lie outside of us. The answers lie inside of us. These religions are always directing people to some imaginary, ambiguous friend in the sky to answer their prayers, to give them guidance, to take them to heaven, to protect them, to love them, because perhaps they can't do that for themselves. And I'm here to tell you that you can. Everything you need is within you. You don't, quote, need, unquote, other people to make you complete. And that's the cool thing about the Metaphysical Church of Humanistic Science. I am not going to tell you that you need me. I am not going to tell you that you need anything. There's only one thing that you need, you. You know, that's why everything I teach is about becoming self-complete. That negates the need for a guru of some sort. You're it, and all you need is you. Doesn't mean you can't seek advice from others. It means that you don't, quote, need it. Your lessons are yours to learn. Use your head. Sure, seek advice if you wish, but make your own decisions. Think for yourself. You must walk your own truth, and you must walk your own path. You must seek self-completeness and self-actualization. And with that, we can now talk more about seeking your own truth, walking your own path. We have with us Reverend Vicki Hunter. She's going to be talking about decisions that are right for you and related matters. Vicki, welcome to the program.
Good day to you. I'm glad we're all still here today.
Yeah, me as well.
You know, the collective unconscious in the mind that Carl Jung talked about, you know, how can someone in New York suddenly wear a miniskirt wear a miniskirt, and then in San Francisco, somebody's wearing a miniskirt that same day, and the trend spreads. And all in a time prior to the communications that we have now. You know, a thought, a collective unconscious. We are all connected. And to me, the mind is the universe, connected to through the umbilical cord, if you will. Pre-birth, during the gestation, we have an umbilical cord that feeds us.
Mm-hmm.
You come outside the mother, you still have that umbilical cord. Everything hits you in that gut feeling. It's always the gut feeling. That's the mind. And then it filters through all the other processes. And this is my simple way of seeing how that works. We're all connected through some other force prior to conception, throughout gestation, while we're here, and go back to the source. And it's what then do you do with being human? I mean, that's the ultimate question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We're in a body. We're in a limited space that has unlimited potential. Still, what do we need? We need to eat. We need a roof over our heads. We need to get through the day. So what does that mean to us? So we have this conversation on quantum mechanics, quantum physics, metaphysical principles. But what does that mean to someone who feels dissatisfied, doing everything they can in the course of a day to the best of their ability? You know, there's a number of things to look at. Are you following what you like? Generally, someone's hobby is what they ought to do for a living. But then that's unrealistic. Well, you're going to have to earn some money and try to get as close to living in a pleasurable way as you can, something that satisfies you. It's a matter of looking at all the things that you do in a day that satisfy that inner mind. It's not just about what you think. Very often what we're thinking, honestly, is just thoughts that come from somewhere else, whether that's a belief system or the society in general. But what do you think for yourself? What do you like? And I'm not talking about immediate gratifications. You know, this is very common now. It's like what gratifies us. It's truly about what do you feel. And we are largely out of touch with our feelings and our senses about things. Kids in school, they plan for university by what the society needs and what mom and dad think that the child should do, so the parents know the child will be okay. But, you know, we've been around in this new culture, this industrialization, long enough to know that when they needed nurses for a few years, they don't need them anymore. So by the time you get there, get your degree, they don't need those nurses anymore. Everybody's unemployed, or they're working part-time, and there's no security. But maybe you never wanted to be a nurse in the first place. Maybe you wanted to be a holistic healer, but that wasn't a cool thing to do. You know, the society doesn't readily accept healers. Well, there was a day when healers were revered in a community. So my point here is we very often follow trendy things that are physically and verbally available as opposed to tuning in to something that creates that movement. And hopefully that movement is more toward independent thinking. And what does that have to do with a miniskirt? Well, mm-hmm. You know, it was a representation of a time back in the 50s, 60s, early 70s of an attempt to break out of the confinements of a society. It was a change, a shift. And we're always in these changes and shifts. Always. It doesn't matter if it was the 1800s, the 1900s, and now we're in this 21st century of more change. The thing is, we're more connected in the written word, the visual stimuli, and more, we need more money to get through a day. So we tend to dream within the confines of those limitations set out for us. So you're only going to dream that far. Well, that's not necessarily being on your true path. It may be, I suppose, if we want to get into semantics about it, say that's what the deal is, and you go forth. But destiny is in my view, in the essence of somebody's design before we get here, there's an essence. And if you're on the planet long enough, you can look back at your life and see that common thread, something that is weaved through. And after a few decades of being on the planet, you say, oh, that's it. Well, we don't want a whole lifetime to pass before we get it. We want to be able to encourage it when it's young. Now, this is a real beef with me, honestly, about people claiming this new cluster of souls and all these wonderful indigo babies, the crystal babies, and, you know, all these special children being born. Are they special? You bet. Every life on Earth is special. But when we impose their idea of what these wonderful souls are supposed to do here, we have created a limitation for them. So this is not necessarily what we want to do. We want children to be able to teach us. We learn about ourselves through children every day. We learn about what we like, what we don't like, how we get irritated, you know, the joys that we feel. We learn about our availability to the human connection. We learn a lot of things in our exchange with children. But we also have to be careful to and give extra attention to listening to the child. What do they need? What do they want? That parent-child connection you spoke about earlier is critical, because I think every parent knows truly that there is something unique about their child. Mm-hmm. But they're afraid of having something unique in their child. They want their child to fit in. They don't want their child to be different. They want their child to be special yet fit in. And this is the boundary we have to break. This
yes.
one thing we must work on. I want my child to be special, but I want them to fit in, can be changed too. I want to lift up the uniqueness and support the uniqueness of my child, and we will work with the realities that we encounter as we get there. No different than the doomsday thing. Mm-hmm. You know, well, hey, I'll work on it when I get there. I can't imagine Visa and MasterCard are having a heyday today. You know, everybody went out and just charged up all their accounts, and today they're, oh my God, I have to pay the bill. And that's essentially what we've been doing in the last few decades of creating confines for self-expression. So you can be an artist so long as I like it. Well, you know, I mean, think about that for a moment. Every expression is an expression. And that is a soul developing. We learn about the natural environment. And the confusion in every individual's mind is, I feel something, but I'm not seeing that to support me. Now imagine being hot off the cosmic plane, and you're a child, and you're seeing all these mixed messages. So a parent can do their very best from the very beginning to impose a support to the uniqueness of a child, find the tools that they want. Kids change their minds all the time, so what? Go with the flow. How can an adult get back on their true path? How can an adult say, I'm not feeling good about my life, this isn't working for me, I'm just really confused? Well, I say, what did you like to do as a child? That's where I begin. What were the things that appealed to you most? What were the things that you did for entertainment that made you curious? And that's not to say that's what you're going to do for a living, but it inspires to remember a creativity. And then you bring in that into the adult experience and say, then I look at my practicality, my sensibilities, and maybe I am a healer. I don't have to be a nurse. I don't have to be a holistic practitioner. But I could be, perhaps in some other way, I can find a venue for that. I don't necessarily have to be a social worker, but I'm a really good mediator. So find that way of expression that's still being true to you, that you can still earn a living. There are many, many variables that people can do. So we can't necessarily, everybody these days wants to be a healer. And why is that? Because they want to heal themselves. So we have to be realistic about your skills, your abilities, your sensibilities. I think every soul wants to help another soul. That's sensible. We're all connected. We all get it. We all feel it. But what if you say, I really am a good healer. I'm really good with people. I'm going to find another way to do this, and I'm happy serving coffee. So maybe you want to open a coffee store. Maybe you just want to go and grow the beans. You know, it's finding your own true expression for what you feel you want to achieve in this lifetime. Now, that's in the doing of things. The essence of destiny is in the learning and the contributing to a humanity. We largely talk about our physical contributions, the financial, economic, materialistic views of things, but it's much greater than that. It's in the essence of our design. It's in that expression of what the soul comes here to fulfill and take beyond this place again. And without going into reincarnation, without going into past lives, future lives, and so on, it is enough to suffice to ourselves to say there's a mystery. I don't understand the mystery. I don't have to understand the mystery. I only need to fulfill myself because it makes me a better being. It makes me a better human being. And when you start living in that, you start feeling joyful. You start feeling positive. You start feeling that you want more of good things around you. You start getting really irritated with negative thoughts. You start getting irritated with negative people. And you can start to decipher truths from things. And a sensibility is, in the event there's a doomsday, okay, well, I'm just going to fulfill what I can today. I'm cool with it. And then we're all dead, so we're in a shared experience. Yeah. You know, it doesn't matter then. Because here's the bottom line, we're all going to leave. And if we all knew exactly what day that was, because the Vikings believed that, you know, they believed live life fiercely. The day of birth and the day of death is marked. Live it fiercely. Fiercely doesn't mean violently, it means passionately. Live it with a full investment of yourself into your life.
Excellent.
So if people can just do a little reevaluation with themselves, do you have hobbies? Because I think a lot of people ought to put down their iPhones and get into a creativity. Uh-huh. And we're losing all of that, and we need to be reconnected with that. So do a little reevaluation for yourself. What do you impart to others to support their individual journey? And we all will learn the skills for living in our day-to-day life. We will learn them. We'll have to. But we don't have to keep telling people what they can't do. Instead, start supporting what we can do.
Excellent advice.
Just simple messages. Simple, simple messages.
Go ahead. You go ahead and then I'll comment.
One thing I want to be, I see this quite frequently, you know, the mixed message of people who are positive negatives. And what I mean to say by that is they talk a lot of positive on the outside. They wear the smiles. They talk about a lot of, you know, seek joy in the divine light, but inside they're negative. And it grates on me because I'm very sensitive to energy. I'm more sensitive to somebody's energy than their words. I get confused, actually, because what I'm feeling and what I'm hearing are not the same. So I worry about what I call the false positives, where it sounds good, it looks good, but it doesn't feel good. You got to go with your feeling and go with the good examples of life, how people actually live it, and how do they deal with challenge, how do they work through challenge, and get off our little, you know, positive soapboxes to get real in that, because the realness is positive, because we're a living positive, not just a thinking or acting positive. It's got to work all through the energy right from the heart.
And that's excellent, excellent points. It underscores the need to be who you are, that you are special just by nature. We all are, as you'd mentioned. And I can't support that enough. And the comment that I wanted to make on something you said just a few minutes ago, on we all have that purpose, right? We all have that purpose that's threaded throughout our lives, that those inclinations, those things we keep coming back to. And it's unfortunate because sometimes it does take some decades to look back and look for those threads. And I, for one, can identify with that. And this has been a recent epiphany for me, because all through my life, I have been doing essentially, well, I've done many things, but one thing keeps reappearing, and that is creating organizations, you know, building organizations. I think they were all dry runs for this, for what I'm doing now, for the Metaphysical Church of Humanistic Science, for the Metaphysics Institute, to teach people practical life skills. It's all kind of come back full circle for me. I've had all that ministerial background in years past, all that experience with a variety of things, and it all comes back to this. And I can't deny that. Well, my question to our listeners is, what's your thread? What's
Absolutely.
Your path?
What's your thread? What is that one thing that you inevitably encounter in mm-hmm. yourself? Where's the place you inevitably end up? And generally speaking, it's the place you don't want. And I'm happy to share this about myself. In my life's work, no matter what I've ever done, I ended up in the media. That scared the hell out of me. I went home. You know, and I would run from that. I'd try to do my work. It just so happened it would gain some popularity. I'd get scared and I'd hide. And this was brought to my attention. Even my children would say, "Mom, you just get so close." And then it slips away. Well, that's because I would run and hide. And I had to reach a place where I say, you know what, it's just part of the deal. Part of the deal of responsibility, part of the deal of doing whatever it is I am to do, and not being afraid. Not being afraid of the reverse side of ego, if you will. When you think it's not just ego that wants the attention, it's also the ego that's afraid of the attention. So when I could look at that and just fulfill whatever it is I'm here to do. I don't pretend to understand what that is. I don't have to. I just have to keep thinking, doing, being, and sharing with others, just as you are. You're a good builder. You're an awesome builder. And to continue to build that, these entities that impart good things. You see, I think we're all that way. We just do it differently.
Of course. Kathy makes a good point in the chat room. There seems to be so much diversity in society today that to find a quote norm for someone to fit into seems to be a thing of the past. Encouraging a person to be a unique individual should be what we strive for as the quote norm nowadays. And
you know that.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry if I can just inject.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's such a beautiful thing there. What Kathy's saying, I can explain that to her, honestly. I just, Eric Fromm, F-R-O-M-M, wonderful philosopher, metaphysician of his time, wrote a book in 1942, I believe. He worried about the onset of industrialization, and he really put it in perspective to me when he said in the same society that when we take away apprenticeship, when we take away what's natural to people and put them in factories, we are taking away their individuality. And certainly we're limiting them to their individuality when we say you can be this, but only within the confines of that. And he warned of a day that the human spirit would try to get out of that box, and that human spirit would then need to be entertained, that the industrialized society would have to find the entertainment for these souls, because we are souls. We are not robots. We are not machines. We are souls. And here we are now. What do you do? How do you find your way back to your apprenticeship for life? And so Kathy's making a very good point. How do you find that? You go back to your apprenticeship. Go back to your nature, what you're good at, not good at, where do you come from. It's a study. You have to sit and meditate on it for a bit.
And that's a beautiful point, because we are individuals, and MCHS Church stresses individuality and the value of the individual rather than other religions who would basically, how do I even put it, put down the individual, make them a number. You know, you might be concealed in the day of God's wrath, yada, yada, yada. It's just, you know, and other religions, even non-Christian religions, devalue the human individualism. Now, I'm not promoting narcissism or egotism. I am saying that each one of us is an individual, and each one of us is valuable, and each one of us has the right, nay, the responsibility to be who we are, provided it harms no one. And so be who you are. Don't get infected with them esteem, as so many people are. That simply means that a person's validation comes from outside of themselves. They only feel good about themselves when they're doing what society says they should do, or what their family says what they should do, or what their religion says they should do. We need self-esteem, internal validation. We are who we are, and we do what is right for us and for humanity.
There are like-minded people who seek the same. Everybody wants to feel safe and belonged. Find the right people to feel safe with and belong to them, while you're belonging to yourself, of course.
Yes. Excellent, excellent points. And thank you very much, Vicki, for coming.
Great show.
Yeah.
Great show, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Now, next week, we're going to, of course, have our program as well. My topic for next week is One Planet, One Race, One Ancestry, One Destiny. It's going to be a discussion of our principle of belief number 7. We'll discuss diversity and equality among peoples and genders. And, of course, Vicki will also come back with a timely topic, a related topic as well.
Look forward to it. Everybody have a good day.
And if you like what you're hearing here, I invite you to join the Metaphysical Church of Humanistic Science. You can find us on the web at mchschurch.org. If you'd like to learn more about metaphysics and even get your own PhD degree in metaphysics, visit metaphysicsinstitute.org. Well, that wraps up this week's program. This is Doug Kelly encouraging you to listen, think, learn, grow, and live. Have a great week.
Empower the Spirit with Dr. Douglas Kelly. To learn more about the concepts presented in this program, visit mchschurch.com. To take a metaphysics course or to get your metaphysics degree, visit metaphysicsinstitute.com.
Power of the Spirit is a production of the Metaphysical Church of Humanistic Science, Incorporated.